Hello, everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 362. We're live tonight on Rumble, Odyssey, and Entropy. Please do share the links if you can, because we've got a wonderful special guest tonight. We've not had her on for a while. We've been explaining why that is pretty soon. Now, I've got loads of things coming up later this week. Tomorrow, I'm live with David Duke at 4 p.m. UK time on the Rents Radio Network. On Friday, I'll have a live stream. I don't know what to do for my Friday live stream. Maybe Laura could help me. Did you see Russell Brand go on the Piers Morgan show and basically completely melt down and make a fool of himself? Some people have emailed me and said you should do a review of it because it's so bad. I don't know if the chat would like to see me do a review of Russell Brand being torn to pieces by Piers Morgan and exposing himself. But if they would, that's something that I can do. I've also got a stream on Sunday, the Nationalist A-Team stream. That'll be me, Sam, Euro and Patriot. Unfortunately, Natty's away on holiday, so it'll be a slightly different lineup this time. But Sam's back, so that's good. So that will still go ahead. Now, I've also got a Substack article coming out on Friday. I posted one on Tuesday. I do two Substack articles a week now, and I've got one coming out on Friday about Jacob Rees-Mogg. He is an absolute anti-white Tory scumbag toff who clearly wants to speed white replacement. I've dug out all of the quotes, all of his opinions, all of the things he's written about this, and you can see why all these civnets who are being conned into supporting him and saying he should join Restore Britain should want Rupert Lowe to have nothing to do with that guy. He's absolute scum. So check that out. That'll be coming out on Friday. It's going to be about 3,000 words, so it's quite a sizable read, but it is certainly worth digesting. And I don't think anyone's done such a deep dive on that Tory snake before, so that should be something new. So I am working extremely hard, putting out at least one piece of media per day. And yesterday, I appeared on a debate on Bear Britain's audits on YouTube. His channel's got 120,000 subscribers. I think the video's had a few thousand views already, so please check that out as well, because it was a good one of those classic Mark Collett debate slash chats where I talk to a civnet and explain why ethnicity matters. So very busy week, which takes me on to the next thing. If you can make a donation towards this stream, if you can contribute to my work, please do. I don't think there's anybody in the nationalist sphere in Britain or abroad that is literally putting out, on average, one piece of media or one appearance per day, which is what I'm doing. So churning out two Substack articles a week and doing at least five media appearances a week is quite big. And this week it's going to be six media appearances. So that's eight pieces of material per week. And I'm also running PA and looking after a young family. So if you support my work and want me to keep doing this and keep producing this media, please do help me. Please consider making a donation, $3, $5, $10, whatever you can afford. And remember, nothing I do goes behind a paywall. So if you support my work, you are helping spread the message for free, because I don't believe in pay gating a solid message, which is what I believe that we do. You can also now subscribe to my Subscribestar. And if you're watching this on replay, please hit the Entropy button and give something. Thousands of people watch these streams on replay. And if you're enjoying them on a replay, please do consider contributing and helping me out. You can also contribute via crypto. All the crypto links are in the description below. And if you need help or if you want to interview me, please write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. I'm very available, very easy to contact, and always here for people in this community. Now, we have a wonderful guest tonight. It's, of course, the lovely Laura Towler. She is the wife of Sam Melia. She hasn't been free to do streams for quite some time because, obviously, with Sam being in prison and then on license, it's meant that she's been sort of tied up looking after the kids. She did an absolute sterling job of keeping the house going and not going insane when she had to do it all by herself. But she's back here for a PWR. And I don't think you've done a PWR for about 70 odd episodes, which is, I think, roughly around the time when I think it was about just after the time Sam went to prison was the last time we did a PWR. So it's a long, long time ago. So we've got a lot to talk about. Usually we do things just relating to PA and PA updates, etc. But tonight we're going to be talking about politics, which is good because me and Laura, that's how we met. And Laura's one of the sharpest political minds that I've ever met. She's somebody who is absolutely dedicated, not just to the cause, not just to our fight for survival, but also to being a mother and bringing up her kids the right way. And people like Laura are very rare in this world, which makes them an incredibly valuable commodity. Anyway, Laura, how are you doing? How is it to be able to be back and do things like this? And genuinely, are the kids better off with Sam looking after them, or would they have been safer just sort of locking them in a room somewhere?
You know, it's funny because people used to call Sam Laura Towler's husband, and you just introduced me as Sam Melia's wife. So who'd have thought, you know, going to prison is the thing that increases your profile. But yeah, Sam's took the kids to the park so that we can have some time to talk about this. And obviously you and I used to do loads of political streams back in the day before I had children. And then when I was 8 months pregnant with mine and Sam's second child, Sam went to prison. So all my focus was on like raising the kids and trying to support Sam as well. And any interview that I did, it was about Sam and getting, you know, publicity about what happened to him out there. And now when you and I do streams, it's usually like maybe a post event sort of like recap of what's happened, a protest or the conference or the camp. And obviously I've been with Patriotic Alternative for 6.5 years since we formed. Absolutely love the organisation. I'll always be here. But a lot of my sort of like outward content now is just about PA, what we've been getting up to, sort of like analysing things and then talking about the future, our solutions. And it's nice just to do a stream tonight and talk about what's been going on in the news and, you know, the political topics that you've put down. I've been reading about them. And yeah, I'm looking forward to a chilled out discussion about them.
Well, there is a lot to talk about. And I'm going to say this as well. When me and Laura do the super chats at the end, if you want to ask us questions, ask us anything. We like these things. And we also sometimes debate each other. Obviously, I'm always the one who's right. But if you want me and Laura to debate something and me to prove a woman wrong live on stream, this is the place to do it, basically. It's all in, you know how it works, you know. Anyway, one of the big things that's been in the press at the moment, and one of the big things that sort of captured everyone's imagination, is the Epstein files and the release of all these documents that have exposed the number of people who have been in the pay of this paedophile sex trafficking Israeli agent. And this has had a number of interesting effects on politics, both on one side of the Atlantic, i.e. in America, but also over here on the other side of the Atlantic, here in the UK. And I never really thought it would blow up like this, because at one point it was all about Prince Andrew, because over here there is this sort of cult of celebrity around the royal family. And if a member of the royal family is up to something or does something embarrassing or is involved in some kind of silly scandal, it's tabloid fodder. So imagine, you know, what the Kardashians are to America, the royal family are essentially to us. And when something happens relating to them, especially when there's a scandal like there was with the then Prince Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein, it made the news and it was relentlessly in the news. And I thought that was going to be the extent of it. And I remember speaking to American content creators who were like, well, it's not really that productive. It's just becoming tabloid fodder. Nobody's talking about the genuine political implications of this. But then all of a sudden, news broke that Lord Mandelson, one of the leading lights in the Labour Party, one of the architects of mass immigration under the Blair government, and also a homosexual Jew, was in the pay of Jeffrey Epstein and had connections to him and was passing sensitive information to him. Not only that, but now it has emerged that due to Mandelson's connections, and we're not sure exactly who these connections are to. I mean, obviously, we're assuming it was Epstein, but it could be to other individuals or other foreign states. Mandelson actually failed his security vetting. Yet the Starmer government insisted that he was given the job anyway. So what this suggests is when you have a powerful Jew who is passing information to a Mossad spy who is also a sex trafficker, all vetting and all scrutiny goes out of the window, and no one in the British government will challenge that. And this has all been coming out in the papers, and it really does. I mean, obviously, everyone knows how much Israel controls America, but you don't often get that kind of talk here in the UK. Here in the UK, the talk of, you know, actual Israeli control and direct intervention in UK affairs isn't as common as it is in America. But this has kind of brought all that to the fore. And I've been having a little bit of a field day with this, because it could be something that actually brings Starmer and his current regime down. What do you think of all this, Laura? Because it has been making the news, and thankfully it's finally eclipsed the issue with Prince Andrew, and it's also been the centre of several major debates in Parliament.
Yeah, so when you messaged me saying that we were going to talk about the Mandelson controversy, I was like, which one? Because it seems like there's always something new with him. And for people who aren't that familiar with him, he was a key person under Tony Blair's government. Obviously, Tony Blair was elected in 1997. And I think as nationalists, we have these people from back then, Mandelson, Jack Straw, Barbara Rush, obviously Tony Blair, who were responsible for immigration in Britain skyrocketing. Lots of people say that mass immigration began in 1948, but it was sort of going like this. And then when Tony Blair came into power, it just went absolutely crazy. And Mandelson obviously famously said that we were sending search parties out looking for immigrants to bring to the UK. He's very anti-white. He's this like just demonic figure to nationalists and people who are interested in that era of politics. And he has connections to Epstein. So it's been confirmed now that he stayed in touch with Epstein after Epstein was convicted of paying underage girls for sex, prostitution of a minor. He stayed in touch with him. And there's all this controversy around him failing vetting, even though he was approved for a senior position in the government. It's like, why do we have these rules and these procedures if people like Mandelson can just bypass them? So politicians, I think it's mainly Conservatives, they've called for a probe into Mandelson, and I think possibly as well into the government's behaviour and how they got away with, you know, appointing him and not looking into this stuff. Did they know about it? And the Epstein stuff as well. And the government led by Starmer is expected to tell Labour MPs to vote against starting this investigation. So, the key thing that I took for it is, if you guys do something bad, you can just say, oh, no, we're not going to investigate that. You know, we're just going to sweep that under the carpet. We're not going to look into it. If you have nothing to hide, you should have no problem with this investigation. But he's just a character to me that's just always just been incredibly anti-British and anti-white. Like you said, he's Jewish, and he worked with Barbara Rush, who said that she just loves being surrounded by diversity because it makes her feel comfortable. And now all this Epstein stuff is coming out, and it's like an additional layer to the anti-British, anti-white stuff. It's this, the connections to what is essentially child rape. So I just hope that more and more comes out about him, and I hope that it can be used to attack Starmer and the Labour government as well.
Well, the interesting thing is, Mandelson is an extremely powerful man, and since this has all started coming out, he has tried to gag the press and the Labour Party, who have been held to some scrutiny due to, you know, a parliamentary investigation over this, have admitted, and I don't know if you've seen the quotes, but there's been several high-ranking sort of parliamentary aides who have said that they were literally berated and sworn at, shouted at, sort of using sort of the harshest kind of words, told, you know, just effing push it through and get it done. So the government was desperate to have this man in the position he was in. And his role ended up being passing crucial information to Epstein, which obviously he was using to make educated bets on the financial market. So, you know, if Mandelson got wind of a piece of policy that might affect, you know, motor cars or be something that pushed green energy rather than oil, he may well pass that information to Epstein, who would, you know, bet against the motor car industry or bet against, you know, the oil industry. And that allowed financial shenanigans to go on, which basically would have made millions, if not billions, for Epstein and his friends. And I'm sure those millions or even billions went toward financing these operations that involved the smuggling and abuse and trafficking of underage white girls. And again, it's incredible, isn't it? Because every time we talk about these horrible crimes that involve people who don't have our interests at heart, once you go downstream from those crimes, they always seem to involve the abuse of white children.
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff that's coming out from the Epstein leaked documents and revealed documents, it's just horrific. I always try and kind of like approach things maybe a little bit timidly and look into it before I believe something, because there are quite a lot of fake screenshots and fake photographs and stuff going around. But even the stuff that's in the real documents, you know, it's just awful the way that they speak about children. What can you even say about it? They got into positions of power. They're in positions of power where they're supposed to be. Many of them are in positions of power where they're supposed to be looking out for the countries that they're leading over. And all they're doing is hurting those people and taking from them. And they seem to do it with complete immunity. And they're confident that nothing's going to happen to them. And they disgust me. And there's only so many names that's been revealed to have been involved in stuff, but there's so many more people that know about it and at least knew about it and did nothing, even if they didn't do something themselves. It's like with the grooming gangs, you know, when people give statistics and say, well, it's this many people. And then you go, well, what about their family members? And what about the people who worked in the takeaways with them? And, you know, these people haven't been convicted, but you tell me they didn't know about it. When a girl was abused and raped by 40 people, are you saying only those 40 people knew about it? Because I guarantee you it was more. And I kind of feel like we're shown just the tip of the iceberg, and there's just so much more that goes on behind the scenes. But this is why I just have no interest. Might be controversial, but I just have no interest really in electoral politics, because I think the whole system is just completely rotten, and it metaphorically needs burning to the ground, and we just need an absolutely new machine. I'm just sick of it. I'd rather campaign for a complete overhaul of the system than a political party and voting, whether that's you know, in a local election or a national election. That's why I like Patriotic Alternative, really, because I think we're a bit more radical with community building, advocacy and activism being the things that we focus on. But yeah, these people are just disgusting. The more that comes out about them, they're just disgusting.
Do you know what I really loved about all this as well? And this was something that it never fails to amaze. It's enraging, but if you don't laugh, you're just going to burn yourself out with anger. So yesterday in the press, the headline read, Starmer's Day of Reckoning, Prime Minister ready to order Labour MPs to vote against Mandelson's sleaze probe. Now, how amazing is that? That we have a political system in this country, which we're told is democracy. But this democracy grants the power to those in charge, those up to their neck in sleaze, to decide whether there will be a probe into their potentially criminal activities. Now, at this point, you've got to say that this isn't democracy, is it? It is sort of like mob. You know, it's like working with the mob. It's like dealing with a criminal conspiracy that, when pulled up on their criminal activities, turn around and say, well, we're going to investigate ourselves. And we've just decided, well, there isn't time for the investigation today because we're all going to retire to the bar. We're all going to have a few drinks. Then we're going to have some nice takeaway and we're going to go home. And that's the end of Parliament for today. And that's literally what they do. They can vote against any probe or any scrutiny they might face. Now, at this point, these people just must be laughing at the general public. What's more, even if by some miracle, rogue or more honest Labour Party MPs were to actually vote for this probe, the government then has the power to seal any investigation, ban the media from reporting on it, and ensure that the public never reads any of the truth on the matter, which they have done. I mean, you know, one famous example of that is the inquiry after the Dunblane massacre, which was sealed for 100 years. I mean, what could have been in that report about those children being shot dead that was so damaging to the British state that no one in Britain will be allowed to read the outcome of that report for a century? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm asking that to you as a question, whether you know. But to me, all of this seems absolutely so broken that I can't understand why any right-thinking person is still endorsing this democracy. So for me,
yeah,
you know, and when I say this, though, I'm the bad guy. I'm like the most banned man in Britain because I'm a threat to our democracy, because I'm the one saying this democracy is a load of rubbish. It's nonsense. It's not democracy. It's basically a group of elected dictators.
Yeah, I mean, you're making me think about freedom of information requests. When they decide that they don't want us to see the information in them, they're just like, not in the public's interest. And I know there's been a lot of that regarding grooming gangs or rape gangs. They said they were going to do this no stone unturned investigation into it. And then they were actually like, oh, no, we'll just write this report where we cite a few old studies. And in these old studies, we've not actually collected the data on ethnicity, so we can't really give you much. And that's another thing as well. Like, why are police recording the ethnicity for the vast majority of crimes? But then when it comes to group-based sexual assault and abuse, we can't record that information. It's like the whole system from the top to the bottom is just completely broken. Or from their perspective, maybe it's doing what they intended to do. I remember regarding the COVID stuff as well, and there were freedom of information requests regarding infant deaths and stuff, and they were just like, not in the public's interest. We're not giving you this. So they're just, I hate them. They're just, yeah, they don't care about us at all. Like I say, they try to operate with complete immunity, and they're confident in doing that. And the sooner that people realise this, the better. They're not on our side.
And the amazing thing is, they keep getting more chances. It's sort of an endless number of chances. I mean, at the moment, it's incredible that Keir Starmer's still in power. And look, I'm not saying the Tories are good guys. I hate the Tories. I despise the Tories. But they do seem to have a shred of shame, in the sense that if their people are embroiled in some kind of scandal, you know, other Tories at least have the kind of common sense to say, maybe you should think about stepping down, mate. But Labour, absolutely shameless. And at the moment, there's something else which is being covered up. Now, people might remember, it wasn't too long ago, but there was a number of fires started at residences owned by Keir Starmer. And apparently a number of his motor vehicles were also targeted as well. And at the time, there was all sorts of conspiracy theories. You know, was it Russian state actors? You know, who can we pin it on? Can we say it's the Iranians? We really want a war with Iran. Can we say it's them? Can we say it's the Palestinians? Come on. But it didn't turn out to be Russians or Iranians or Palestinians. It turned out to be a group of young, fresh-faced Ukrainian rent boys. Now, those Ukrainian rent boys are currently on trial at the moment, and you will have noticed a complete lack of coverage about that issue in the press, because apparently the government has put a gagging order on the press and media and reporting restrictions on this trial. So what the hell is going on? Is Keir Starmer using rent boys? I mean, why would three rent boys from the Ukraine target Keir Starmer? And if they didn't know him and didn't know him quite, what can we say, intimately, how would they know what his vehicles were? How would they know where his residences were? Because, I mean, I'd argue that other than some smart aleck who's going to say, well, he lives at number 10 Downing Street, mate. Yeah, well, we know that. But his private residences and private motor vehicles probably do not appear in public records for obvious reasons. But isn't it weird that a group of Ukrainian rent boys had all that information? Yet that's being swept under the rug as well. I mean, what is going on? You know, was it Starmer booking young twinks so he could give them a good bumming? Was it somebody at his residences? Is his wife, you know, in some kind of, you know, lavender marriage with him? Because she is Jewish, and his children, he boasts, he brings them up observing Jewish law, which is very interesting, isn't it? Is this another case of a British prime minister with or married to an Israeli agent? Because he was pretty eager to get an Israeli agent operating at a high level under him, which was Mandelson. What is going on, Laura? Is the entire Labour government completely controlled by Israel? And is Starmer a secret bummer?
I don't really know what to say to that, Mark. I mean, apart from the Israel bit, I would probably add another layer to that and say not just the Labour government, but the Tories as well, and many of the other parties have very strong ties to Israel, and Jews living in Britain as well. But yeah, I mean, do you know the Ukrainian story? I remember that was a while back, wasn't it? I remember like hearing about it, and I haven't heard anything about it since, and I haven't followed the story. I actually forgot about it until you brought it up just then. But are you following it then? Are you searching for?
Well, I get most of it from David Clues, because David Clues has done some investigation, and he's actually put together a load of really, really interesting stuff about this. And I was kind of looking at it and thinking, well, you know, what can I make of it? But now other people have got on it, and there's been several content creators starting to speak about this and saying, like, what on earth is going on here? You know, we've got a prime minister who is in this weird sort of lavender marriage. He's, you know, he looks like a bit of a metrosexual. He's somebody who was known when he was in the CPS to have essentially turned a blind eye to serious child abuse on numerous occasions, and let people who had abused children in horrific ways and really, really, you know, high profile abusers get away. He was the one in charge of the CPS when they decided not to charge Jimmy Savile, you know, although he claims he never even heard of the case, you know, as if anyone that believes that must have had a lobotomy. But there is obviously something going on here. And I think the Epstein case, and I know this is probably a little bit of an explosive thing to say, but I think it's probably the tip of the iceberg, because for years people have been talking about widespread sexual abuse and perversion in the highest halls of power. And I think Epstein is just part of that. And I think there's a lot more of this going on. You've obviously got Mandelson, you've got Starmer. Who knows what else you've got going on in Parliament? But it appears to me that this current Labour government are, you know, only less than 2 years into their term, but they're embroiled in so much sleaze already. And that's another thing with the Tories. I'm not saying the Tories aren't sleazy, but like it takes about sort of 10, 15 years for the Tories to build up a decent portfolio of sleaze. But Labour just seem to be speed running it this time. It's like, look, hold my beer. We're going in hard. How bad can we do in 2 years? Well, in 2 years, they're basically been, in some respects, the worst government we've ever had.
I mean, so many people do know about this stuff and have just said nothing, because there are people who've tried to, I mean, Jimmy Savile, there were people who tried to make that public. Was it Johnny Rotten from the Sex Pistols? He tried to make it public and he ended up getting banned from being on the radio and stuff. And he watched some interview that he did with Piers Morgan where he said, like, look, I warned about this back then. And you could hear him talking about it. They played the clips and they were just like, no, shush that up. So many people at the BBC, in the government, people who are in these circles knew about it. And not only did they not do anything about it, but they silenced people who tried to speak up about it. So, like I said earlier, you know, the bits that we know, it's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so very obviously so much more going on behind the scenes.
It is very interesting to see that this is a cross-party thing as well, because these child abusers have been found in Labour, in the Lib Dems and in the Tories. But isn't it incredible that all of those parties have repeatedly pushed for criminal reforms that have allowed child abusers and people who have been grooming children, people who have been found with, you know, sometimes hundreds of thousands of indecent pictures of children on their computers, they've allowed them to walk free from court with suspended sentences. I mean, when you look at it, could you really have a more twisted form of governance than one which legislates for paedophiles to walk free from court with just a few meetings with probation? Whereas, you know, your husband who stuck up stickers, they made his life not only difficult by sending him to prison. But I said this to Sam, and this is a really weird take, and it'll probably annoy you because it's probably the opposite of what you thought. But I said to Sam, in a way, I felt his time in prison actually treated him more fairly than his time at the hostel. When you read his book, he was actually treated better in prison, and it seemed a fairer life for him in prison than it was when he got released and he had to answer to probation, to MAPPA, to Prevent, to the counter-terror guys. Once he was actually released and he wasn't in that prison cell, they were the sort of mental torture he went through with them trying to make his life so difficult and hang this sort of like sword of Damocles above his head, like, you put one step, you know, one foot out of line and you're going back to prison. It was absolutely shocking. But this isn't what these paedophiles face.
No, I agree with that, because when Sam was in prison, the prison officers, I mean, obviously I visited him every week, so I saw a lot of them and I got to know a lot of them. There were a few of them, quite a lot of women working in prisons, actually, especially in Hull. And there were a few of them that were like just proper feminists, you know, with stupid like purple mohawks and stuff. But the vast majority of prison officers Sam got on with really well, and they were really, they disagreed with his, not only him being sent to prison, but his conviction. And they were supportive of the cause as well. And then the prisoners as well, especially in Hull, where it were overwhelmingly white, a lot of the prisoners were on his side. So he did have a decent time in prison, if you can say that. The hardest thing was being away from the kids and the boredom, but it wasn't difficult for him. They didn't like mentally try to torture him and, you know, that kind of stuff, take things away from him and that kind of stuff. But when he was released, I mean, his probation officer was such an arsehole. Honestly, if you've read his book, Dick is called by name and by nature, he was just awful. He phoned me up and he was like, I want to come and see you, and I was like, well, what do you want to come and see me about? And he's like, I'm not allowed to tell you, I'll tell you when I get there. And I was like, well, is it about Sam's license conditions? And he's like, no, I'm bringing counter-terrorism and I want to come and see you. And I was just like, no, you're not, bye. And I just hung up on him, and since then I never spoke to him again since that. But he was just so entitled and so, like, he'd have all the, you know, like all the typical shit lib arguments, like Windrush generation and we need him for the NHS and what do you mean black British people aren't white British, all this stuff. And when Sam would beat him in a debate, he'd just be like, he'd move on to the next thing. And then Sam would say in the next conversation, you said this, and he'd be like, no, I didn't say that. And it's like, okay. But the difficult thing was he was in the position of power. So Sam had the ability to send Sam back to prison. So Sam had to sort of really bite his tongue and try and just get through it. So I agree with you. I think it was harder for Sam really when he was out of prison, because even though he was allowed to come back home through the day, it was constantly on edge and he was really stressed out, thinking, am I going to get recalled? Am I going to get recalled? And then once the 1st of March came and he was completely free, it was a massive weight off his shoulders.
It was interesting as well when you're reading his book, because you kind of got this feeling that they knew how uncomfortable it was for Sam. They knew that now he'd got that taste of being at home and seeing his daughters again and seeing his wife, but constantly having him dangling on that string gave them a lot of power. And I do notice that in the system that we live in, there are these huge abuses of power. And one of the things that really angered me when I was reading the book is he would talk about these people coming into the hostel. And they were only there for 2 weeks to a month, but they'd committed serious crimes. You know, they had, you know, abused their wives, they'd beaten somebody up, stabbed somebody, they'd been selling drugs, and they'd be breaking the terms of their release, they'd be coming in drunk. There was one great bit in the book where he said he was playing on the Xbox, and they came in to do the wellness check to see if everyone was sober and sort of, you know, fully compos mentis. And he said he was playing on the Xbox and the other three guys in there were just either drunk or high and just lying there with like their tongues hanging out of their mouth, dribbling like retards. And Sam's just there playing the Xbox and like, so everything's okay in here. And they turned a blind eye to it. But I can tell you, if Sam was getting a little bit silly or, you know, was a little bit rambunctious, they'd be like, right, we need to give you the blood alcohol test. We need to give you the drug test. And it was quite enraging the way they treated him. Now, I want to sort of move on to another story, because this story is probably something people are going to find quite amusing, but it's also something that we do need to talk about because there's a serious edge to this. Now, I read this and I posted this. It was in the BBC the other day, so I'm going to read the headline directly. Arsonist who torched asylum seeker hotels jailed. Now, you might remember a while back, it was in the news that far-right thugs were a threat to these asylum seeker hotels. Several hotels had been set fire to. Was this a far-right plot? Were we dealing with far-right terrorists? You know, can you imagine the horrors that could have unfolded? All these poor women and children in hotels cowering for their lives, potentially roasted to death when these far-right thugs were setting fire to the hotels. But then it all went quiet and we never found out who the far-right thugs were. We never found out the details of this far-right terror plot. You know, none of these women and children got roasted to death. Everything was just quietly shelved. Well, it's not being shelved anymore. It's come out in the papers and I'm going to read this. I'll probably get his name wrong, but I'm going to do my best. His name is Rawand Abdulrahman. Rawand Abdulrahman torched the hotels, according to the BBC, in order to get better accommodation. So when the papers were all going crazy about right-wing thugs or a right-wing terror plot and, you know, all these poor asylum seekers in fear of their life, the person actually setting fire to the hotels was an asylum seeker. And he wasn't setting fire to the hotels because he was against mass immigration or because he was worried about demographic change in Britain and he wanted to stop people crossing the borders illegally. No, he was setting fire to the hotels because he thought the hotels that he was being housed in weren't as good as other hotels that other asylum seekers has been housed in. So he wanted a better class of hotel, a better lunchtime buffet, maybe a jacuzzi, potentially, you know, a massage service. I don't know. But he wasn't getting what he'd hoped for. So he started setting fire to the hotels. What do you think to that, Laura? I mean, it is funny, but it's also kind of enraging because when things like that happened, I was expecting new laws to come in, protests to be banned outside the hotels because that's what we were talking about. And in the end, it's actually one of the migrants who did it.
So it was Rawand Abdulrahman, and he was convicted after setting fire to two hotels that were used to house asylum seekers, and he was just jailed this month for 8.5 years. Now, he actually started the fires in his own bedrooms. So, you know, he's obviously not the brightest spark, no pun intended, but his motive was to try and get better accommodation for himself. I don't know if you read that during questioning with the police as well, he said that it was a ghost that started the fire in his room. And surprisingly, that argument didn't work. He was still found guilty.
I'm shocked it didn't.
Do you know what it reminds me of? Do you know when you see the graffiti of the swastikas on like Jewish graveyards buildings, and then they look at the CCTV and it turns out to be a rabbi and it's like a fake crime? It was like that. But the thing that annoys me is this guy is called an asylum seeker, so he's supposed to be fleeing persecution. If you are fleeing persecution, shouldn't you be happy with where you're living? The fact that you're safe, you've got a roof over your head, you've got food, you've got free dentist. I have 2 children aged 4 and 2. I managed to get into a dentist with my oldest, Catherine, who's 4, 6 months ago. It took us 3.5 years to get a dentist. And these people are getting free dentists, free healthcare. It's just absolutely atrocious. These people are not asylum seekers or refugees. They're economic migrants. And all they're doing is coming to this country for a better life. And when they do come here, they're just so ungrateful. And I'm just sick of them. I'm sick of every single one of them. These asylum accommodations, sometimes it's military bases, sometimes it's hotels, different buildings. Every single one of them needs shutting down. And every single one of these people needs rounding up and taking back to where they came from. It's not our problem. I'm sick of it. If you want to complain about why we're doing that and if it's too harsh, blame the people that took the mick, because British people shouldn't have to put up with this too much. I'm going on a rant now. But also, not only are they setting fire to their own hotels and sponging off the British state, but they're going around committing crimes, like the recent demo that we did in, was the last one that we did in Nuneaton?
Yeah.
Where there'd been a rape of a young girl in a park. It's just, they shouldn't be here. They need to go home. I'm sick of them. It is a funny story, but it does reveal quite a lot about how these so-called refugees and asylum seekers treat this country, and how it went, you know, like Mark says, they so desperately wanted to blame it on the far right, you know, in order to curb our free, what little left we have of our freedoms even more.
I think the thing that I find sort of most amusing about this is obviously this guy wasn't the brain of Britain, right? He was obviously pretty thick and he got caught, but he only got 8.5 years in prison. Now, I know people are going to say that's a substantial sentence, but if a white guy had set fire to 2 asylum seeker hotels, what do you think the sentence would be? Because, I mean, let's face it, there have been white guys jailed for 5 years, which is half a decade, for saying things online. We know somebody, I mean, James Costello, he said things online and he was sentenced to 5 years in jail. Now, this guy could have killed dozens of people, maybe hundreds. I don't know how many were housed in the hotels. And he got 8.5 years. I reckon if white people had done this, I think they would have been lifed off. I think there may well have been a life sentence and they would have thrown everything at it. It wouldn't have just been arson. I think they would have gone for attempted murder. I think there would have been maybe a terror offence tacked on there. And of course, you would then also get potentially up to a 40% uplift on the eventual tariff due to a racial motivation. So you'd have terror, which obviously makes it even worse. You have the racial motivation, and they wouldn't have just gone with arson. It would have been, you know, attempted murder or wounding with intent or, you know, reckless endangerment to life. There would have been so many other things sort of tacked on. So when it came down to it, I think you'd have been looking 10 to 15, maybe a life sentence, and then maybe a decade afterwards on some kind of restrictions that prevented people from owning a smartphone, going online. They'd only be able to work in special places that were approved by the government. So, like, you know, you'd go to work in a warehouse, but you wouldn't be able to use, you know, the little PDA to do the picking and packing, because you wouldn't be allowed to touch anything like that, because it might be able to connect to the internet. There's no way they would have got 8.5 years.
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, it's the same sentence that Ash Sharp got. He got 8 years for having a document on his computer that the defence proved he'd never read. With Sam, he was convicted of a public order offence. They tried to get a terrorism charge there, but they didn't have anything. So he was convicted of a public order offence. And they, throughout his whole ordeal, they called it terrorism adjacent. So he had the same rules that a terrorist, and I'm saying terrorist in quote marks, because what is a terrorist nowadays? It's someone who says nice things about white people. But throughout the whole ordeal, he was treated like a terrorist. And that I completely agree that it would have been a much longer sentence to begin with, but then once they got him into the system as well, they would have just made it so much harder. I mean, this guy will get out early and then he'll be free and he'll probably get to stay in the country forever and he'll be given a British passport and he's just as British as us. But if it was a white guy doing it, it would have been called terrorism. They probably would have tried to change laws or introduce new laws in order to, once again, stop our freedoms, what little we have left of them. And then his whole life would have been hell. He wouldn't have been able to leave the country. He would have had this extended license period where he's not allowed to do anything. I agree with that entirely.
I mean, it is crazy just how much two-tier justice, you know, as much as they say it's a meme and it's sort of it's far right, two-tier justice is a very, very real thing. I mean, I think there's going to be, I mean, I don't know if you've seen this, there's breaking news right now that apparently someone with a knife has attacked two Jewish men in Golders Green. And I think there's going to be new laws. You've already got Kemi Badenoch saying there's been an epidemic of violence against Jewish people. And she says we need to drain the swamp. I mean, I don't know what drain the swamp means. What's she even talking about?
Well, that doesn't even make sense, because what you're gonna. I mean, who is she assuming the perpetrator is?
Well, the man who's been arrested is a 45-year-old man with a serious history of violence and mental health issues. Now, this is something that I find really, really both amusing and enraging. You and I both know that if a guy who had a long history of violence and serious mental health issues had attacked white people, it would be straight under the rug. They'd push it under the carpet. You know, the guy would be immediately, all charges would be immediately dropped. He would be detained under mental health, legislation, just like, you know, Valdo Calicane, the Nottingham killer. It was a mental health issue and everyone had to go and stand in Nottingham city centre and hold up banners that said love Nottingham, you know, love Nottingham, Nottingham loves, you know, that's what it was all about. It was all about love and peace and don't look back in anger. When it happens to Jews, it's never don't look back in anger, is it? It's never, well, it was mental health issues. It's never, oh, well, you know, we need to be compassionate and understand what the crazed knife man was going through. But when it's white, that's exactly what it is. And when it's white, you can never say it's anti-white, can you? You can never say Valdo Calicane was an anti-white nutcase who wanted to kill white people. Anyone who would have said that at the multi-faith kumbaya ceremony that took place in Nottingham city centre after his spree killing would have been thrown out. When it happens to Jews, there's no don't look back in anger. It absolutely is anti-Semitic, and we need to totally change legislation surrounding what people can and can't say in the country. And again, it's another massive double standard.
It doesn't even have to be Jewish people. Jewish ambulances, and it's enough. Jewish vehicles, and it's enough. The response regarding that was stronger than I've heard about young white girls. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned earlier about crimes against children, which are just the most horrific crimes. I mean, there's been people who have had category A images of children, which are the worst type of image. I'm not even going to go into detail of what they entail, but the worst type of images, hundreds of them on their computer, and they've just received suspended sentences. So they're allowed to just continue walking about. I mean, even in prison, you know, the hierarchy is that people who commit crimes on children are just vermin and scum, and if you walk into general population, you'll get attacked. But in the legal system, or in the entire system, I suppose you could say, they don't even seem to take those crimes seriously. And since becoming a mum, I feel like I have more empathy, like, not towards everyone, obviously. I'm not spotting open borders or anything, but things hit me harder than they did before. It's probably like a hormonal thing where your body changes because you're supposed to be bonding with your baby or something, but things seem to hit me even harder. And when it's a crime involving a child, it really, really upsets me. And I don't see why those in charge don't take it seriously and why they give such light sentences when it's to do with children, people who are innocent and can't protect themselves.
Well, do you know the amazing thing about this attack on these two Jews? And I'm not endorsing the attack at all. But what I am saying is the government has already called an emergency response COBRA meeting. Now, they never called a COBRA meeting after the Southport murders. They never said that Axel Ruder Cabana was a terrorist. They've already said this is a terror incident, even though the man arrested is known to have a history of mental health issues. And it, again, there's this massive double standard. When something happens to Jews, the government immediately convenes a COBRA meeting. The Prime Minister, I'll tell you exactly what's being said on the BBC. And this tells you the difference in the kind of responses. This is the latest post, and it was made by the BBC at 12 minutes past seven this evening. The Prime Minister says more funding is needed to give the level of protection that is needed for the Jewish community. Starmer made the comments following a COBRA meeting that was convened in order to coordinate the government's immediate response to the attack. The Prime Minister will also be meeting with the criminal justice agencies tomorrow. He says he's spoken with the Community Security Trust, an organisation which provides security for Jewish people, adding there is enhanced funding already in place. We need to increase that to give the level of protection that's needed. Now, they're already saying that the man was linked to a group that was linked with Iran, saying that Iran was behind the attack. I mean, you know, who knows? It sounds a little bit convenient, but it does. One thing that you can say, I mean, Kemi Badenoch at 8 minutes to six this evening calls Jewish safety a national emergency. I mean, what a complete piece of shit she is. What a complete piece of shit. I mean, when 100,000 or more white girls are raped by Muslim men, it's not a national emergency. In fact, there needs to be a cover up. We need to assess things with a calm head. When two Jews are stabbed, it's a national emergency. I mean, yeah, am I living in the twilight zone?
No, it's just disgusting. And I don't really hear you swear on stream much, but it deserves it because, I mean, you know, young girls in Rotherham aren't lining the pockets, are they? They don't care about them. It's just, it really is disgusting. Like, where's the extra safety for young white girls? You know, where's the extra safety for little girls in parks and stuff? It's special. They are the top group that get the most privileges more than anyone. It's just, all you can do is point it out, really.
Well, it's amazing, isn't it? Because I'm not saying that anyone should be stabbed, right? No one should be stabbed walking down the streets of Britain. Simple as that, right? And anyone who goes out to stab an innocent person, you know, is inherently bad and should be arrested. But to suggest that the stabbing of two people gets this kind of disproportionate response really is the government spitting in the face of families in Rotherham, Telford, Rochdale, South Manchester. This is the government spitting in the face of the families of the Nottingham victims, of the Southport victims, because there was never that response. There is never a community security response when white people are targeted by migrants. I mean, we are seeing now every week, at least one case coming to the media, serious cases of rapes and sexual assaults carried out against white girls by roaming gangs of migrants who have been housed in hotels. But there is never even the suggestion that these girls should be protected or get special protections, or that there should be special funds set up to protect white people from the migrants that are coming in. And again, this is about a disproportionate response that all points in the direction of something that we have been talking about for a long time. And that is that Jews are top of the ethnic totem pole in our society. And when anything happens to a Jew, it is used to A, give them even more power, and B, silence their critics to a greater degree. Because if tonight you turn around and say, well, aren't they making a very big deal about this? You're going to be shot down in flames. I mean, I would argue that politicians, well, there's no argument. You know, Starmer never convened a Cobra meeting after Southport. There is only ever an immediate high-level government response meeting when something happens to Jews. That's just the fact of the matter.
Yeah, and you know, look at the Manchester Arena bombing was probably the most obvious example of that with the Don't Look Back in Anger. And was it the Independent who published an article saying the best thing that we can do is absolutely nothing, because they were basically saying just carry on as normal. It's like, you know, 22 people, including little girls, 8-year-old girls, are dead, and the best thing that we can do is carry on as normal. And it's the complete opposite to what you're talking about now if it's a different ethnic group.
And the amazing thing is, this is all just going to get much, much worse, because I don't know if you've seen the projections for net migration over the next 8 years. And they are massive. The government is stating that in the next 8 years, they are going to allow 7.3 million more migrants to enter Britain legally. Now, that's an incredible amount of people. You're talking, 900,000 people plus per year. But the incredible thing about it is they're saying, oh, yeah, but net migration is going to be much, much lower. Over the 8 years, net migration is only going to be 2 million. How do they know that? How do they know how many are going to go back? Because they don't. They know how many they're going to let in. And that number will rise over time. Mark my words, you know, clip this out. That's my prediction. That number will only go on to rise. And it doesn't include illegals. But one of the interesting things is when people come out with this crap argument of net migration. Net migration is one of the worst arguments people can make when you're analysing demographics. Because let's say 7.3 million Somalians were to come to Britain, and then 5.1 million white Britons say, I've had enough of all these Somalians. We're going to go and live in Thailand. We're going to go and live in Spain. We're going to go and live in the south of France. We're going to live out our days in Tenerife or Cyprus, somewhere nice and warm. The government would turn around and go, well, net migration's only 2.2 million. And it's like, that's not the point. That's not the point. We've just brought in 7.3 million people who are completely different to us. That has scared away 5.1 million white Brits who just can't stand it anymore. That's not a positive. That is a demographic shift on an unprecedented level that makes life unbelievably harder for the people, for the white Britons who remain. And I think going forward, we're going to see this statistical trickery play out more and more. But one thing that was interesting when I saw these figures coming out and about, Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, was actually alluding to this. She was actually saying, well, don't worry, because net migration isn't going to be that high, because many Brits are now choosing to live out their retirement abroad. So basically, that's it, isn't it? Those who can afford to flee will flee. Those who've got the guts or haven't got the financial means or aren't legally allowed to travel will stay and struggle it out. And that's how a nation dies an undignified death. They import so many people that those who can flee the sinking ship do. And the ship sinks with people like me and Laura and Sam still on board flying the flag.
Yeah, I mean, it matters from our perspective, and I'd say that it matters from the British public's perspective, but they'll just argue, well, you know, all of these people are British, so the net migration figure is the one that we should look at. But I just find it depressing. I mean, when we first farmed in September 2019, I was like up on all the statistics. I knew the 2011 census like the back of my hand. And if you would have said, what's this figure? I'd have been like 87.3%. And then we were waiting for the 2021 census to come out. And we said it's going to be about 70% white British. And it's for 2021, but it takes a couple of years until you've got the full thing. It came out. And we were spot on with our prediction. It was around 70% white British. And I think since then, I just find it so depressing. And I don't follow the statistics as much. It's not a case of burying your head in the sand because I know what's going on. I know what I'm against. I'm a nationalist. It's my job to work at Patriotic Alternative. But I just find it so depressing, especially the births. So the live births in England and Wales is just over half white British. And then if we go up in age, you know, primary school kids and then secondary school kids. The younger you get, the more foreign it is. And it's just so depressing. And but also I think when I'm speaking to people now, whether it's a debate or a speech at a demo or a speech at a conference or anything, I feel like people relate more to personal stories rather than just a number. So you can shove a statistic in front of them and say, this figure is this, but it doesn't really mean anything to them. But if you say, this happened to a person where I live, I don't know why they respond. What's that quote? The death of one is a tragedy, the death of millions is just a statistic. I think people do relate better to like stories about individual cases, but I would actually like to update the Patriotic Alternative website and get all the new data and, you know, census information on there so that if you do need to grab it for an argument or a debate or something, it's all there and it's all, you know, broken down into bite-sized chunks. No rubbish, no net migration, just proper, this is the demographics of the country. And that's a job that I will start soon.
Well, it's interesting because I think you're right, and I think people can get overwhelmed with statistics. But as sort of a kind of blokey guy, I do look at those big picture statistics probably more than I look at individual cases. And something that I'm going to say, which is pretty grim, and you and I have never talked about it on stream, and it's probably the kind of thing that I would like to talk about with you at length, sort of on a more kind of focus stream, because obviously we are two of the most famous ethno-nationalists in Britain, and we put in a lot of work, but we're also people who think and discuss this. Now, I don't want to be Mr. Black Pill, but I would say I'm a pretty intelligent guy, and I say I'm pretty good at sort of like game theory, sort of looking at facts and statistics and seeing how difficult it is to win in certain scenarios. And that's mainly probably because I'm a bit of a gamer and because I play games like RTS games or turn-based strategies where you have to sort of work out the statistics. You know, will these troops, what are the percentage chance of these troops winning if they engage these troops in this terrain, you know, in this weather, you know, at this time of day? And you sort of work it out and think, is it worth committing my resources to that? And there's sort of a high level thinking there, kind of like playing chess. But the more I look at the statistics, the harder I think it's going to be for us to turn this around now. Because we are seeing us reaching this critical point. And I was talking to a good friend of mine, not actually, this wasn't you that I was discussing this with, but it was a guy who's been sort of very supportive of PA. I'm still very good friends with him. He's been with us from the start. He's not as active as he once was. But I was saying to him, according to all data that we have, in the year around 2025, we fell to 70% of the population. So it's now 30% of migrant background, 70% white British. Now, even if half of the white Brits, half, and that's a big ask to say that half of white British people would all vote for the same party. And I think that's the upper limit you're going to get, really. Even if half all voted for an anti-immigration party, once you dip under the 70% mark, it gets progressively harder for that anti-immigration party to win. Because if half the white Brits left vote for, say, reform or restore, and they all voted for the same party, that would be around 35% at a general election, which is what you need to win it. But once you get down to about 65%, even if half of those people voted the same way, that's only 32.5%, which is on the knife edge of what you need to win a general election. And once you get down to 60%, which is only 12 to 15 years away from where we are now, it gets that much harder. And at that point, unfortunately, the only way to win at the ballot box would actually be to appeal to members of migrant communities that we had some synergy with. And at that point, you're actually in a situation where you have to form some kind of ethnic coalition to have any chance of victory, which is why I'm so downbeat about the electoral path and why I'm so much more upbeat about creating intentional communities where we can decide who lives there and thus control pretty much what the voter base will be within a specific area, which wouldn't grant us national power, but would grant us a degree of autonomy over our own area.
Yeah, I agree. And our people are, many of our people don't think along ethnic lines, but every other group does think along ethnic lines. And it's something that we've had beaten out of us our whole lives. In fact, more than our lives, going back numerous generations. If you look at statistics about in-group preference, it's only white people, especially white liberals, who don't have a preference for their own race, or at least say they don't. So, yeah, it's just, I mean, just to go off topic, do you know what I want? I want there to be a zombie apocalypse, because I know that we'll be all right. Like, our guys will be all right. we could create some sort of building and, like, lock ourselves in, and can you tell I'm watching Walking Dead at the minute? But I don't know, I guess I just want some sort of collapse and some opportunity to rebuild from the rubble, because I think that our guys will be all right. I feel like we're very self-sufficient. I feel like we've got a lot of skills. And look at white liberals, they're not going to last 2 minutes. They'll just have to go and live among the people that they apparently love so much, and good luck to them. But yeah, I really just do want them there to be some sort of collapse and an opportunity for us to create something new.
You know what? It's interesting you say that, because when COVID came about and when there was legitimate fears initially that there was going to be loads of people who were going to die, I remember the wife saying to me, what are we going to do? Should we go and bulk buy? I said, no. I said, the shops open at 6 a.m. The white British people are largely lazy. They'll be queuing at around 6 p.m. for the last two toilet rolls. I said, what I'm going to do is every morning, because the shelves are a bit bare, I'm going to go down when Tesco opens at 6 a.m. and I'm going to get everything we need and any fresh produce that's put on the shelves at 6. I'll be back home by nearly 7. I won't have to see many people. It'll be a morning out, which I quite enjoy. And you know what? We'll have fresh food every day. And all these bozos that are fighting over toilet rolls at 6 p.m. and buying 400 steaks, which they then throw out because they're so dopey, they don't realise 400 steaks don't fit in the fridge. And if you are prepping, the last thing you do is buy steak because it doesn't keep. And that literally did happen. There was that sort of week or so after the mad panic buying. And they reckon that millions of pounds worth of fresh meat was discarded because people literally didn't understand that if you're prepping, you buy cans, you buy highly processed things like crisps, cake bars and anything that will last for years. But obviously the divvies that didn't watch The Walking Dead thought they'd buy 40 chickens and 200 steaks. I mean, oh my God. And at that point I thought to myself, you know what, this isn't going to bother me, it's not going to affect me. I said to the missus, we're going to be fine. And she said, are you sure? I said, yeah, just trust me, I'll think our way out of this. And we were fine. And we never had to fight people over toilet roll. We never had to carry on with people. We never had to queue for anything. We just operated in a way that circumvented the problem. And I think that if there was a zombie apocalypse, I'd probably be laughing. I think, within about 6 months, people would be calling me King Mark, maybe Emperor Mark. I think I prefer that title. And, basically, that would be it, wouldn't it? We'd be sat pretty on a massive, I'd be sitting on a throne of canned food you know, with a shotgun resting on my knee, and we'd be deciding, you know, which county we were taking back next. It would be absolutely glorious. But instead, you know, we're here living under the yoke of these Zionist tyrants. Anyway, it's, you know, if people want to talk more about this, we can. But look, we've had a few super chats in tonight. Come on, guys. It's halfway through the show. We're going to do the super chats now. Please, please, please do consider giving something if you can. You know, I know things have been tight recently and I know super chats have been down. I keep saying this, but if you can, please do give through one of these means. And if you can't and you'd prefer to give in another way, you can go and subscribe to me over on Substack. You can go and make a regular donation or subscription, and that is massively appreciated. You know, that is another way you can do it, and it means that you don't have to sign up for something like Entropy, which some people are scared of signing up for. So if you want to do it that way, you can, but please do consider doing something. Times are difficult, and if you can help me out, I would be super appreciative, because as I said, this month has been a slower than usual month because of the problems with Entropy, and you know, it just, you know, I know that people are finding it hard with all of the price rises and things, but if you can help, please consider doing so, because we're still out there doing a lot of good work. The Flying Dutchman gave $20. Thank you so much. He said, enjoying Sam's book, almost finished. What a shameful circus you all endured, but now Laura can drive a car on the right side of the road. That's our good friend.
Yeah, so I know. So the Flying Dutchman has been in our car before, but I couldn't drive at the time. Only Sam could. So I passed my driving test when Sam was in prison, just because it was just really hard getting about with the two kids, you know, on the bus. Like if I want to go over and see my family in Leeds, it was two buses to get over. So yeah, I passed my driving test when Sam was in prison, and I honestly don't know how I lived without it. You know, just being able to get to different places, just going to the shop as well. It's just so much easier. Obviously, I still do a lot of walking if it's within distance, but yeah, it's life-changing. I should have done it when I was 17.
Do you know what? I've gone the opposite way. So since I moved out of Leeds and went to the countryside, I've actually started walking everywhere. And do you know what? This is going to be a controversial take, but you know when the government were talking about those 15-minute cities? Like, I would love to go back to a low population country where every village had its own butchers, bakers, greengrocers, and that rather than driving everywhere, you could actually walk or cycle. Now, when my grandparents lived in a little village called Heckington, and they never owned a car, they would bike to the shops, and they'd go to the greengrocers, they'd go to the butchers, they'd go to the bakers, they'd go to the paper shop to get some, you know, sweets for their grandkids, and everything ran really nicely. Everyone knew each other. And I'm not saying we should go to a carless world. I'm not some green energy maniac. But I would like to see us go back to a world where we were more connected to local people. We did have communities. We were more sparsely populated. And people weren't being forced to do these sort of hour-long commutes and sit in traffic every day. Have I gone mad? Or is there a certain,
I think most nationalists would agree with that. I mean, this morning, Sam was doing some Grandma Towler's work, so I had the two kids, and we went to the butchers, and then we went to the greengrocers, and then we went to the library, and then we went to see a relative. And it was just really nice just pottering about and being able to walk everywhere. But I think the reality is, you know, we're not getting a butcher, a greengrocer, a cobbler and a bakery. We're getting a vape shop, a mobile phone repair shop and a Turkish barbers, because that's what the high streets are full of nowadays. So I think there's, you know, wishing for something in an ideal situation and then wishing for something as it is. And the ideal situation is much nicer than reality.
Look, I agree with that. I mean, it's kind of like, I would say it's the argument for national service. So if we had a nationalist government, the leader of the country, I would want national service. But national service under a nationalist government that doesn't promote foreign wars would be a good thing. National service under a Zog government that wants us to go off and fight Russia in eastern Ukraine or fly the lads out to Iran is a terrible thing. And my position is quite clear, really, that when it comes down to it, you know, there is policy making for the ideal world, and there's policy making for a broken world. And what is good policy in an ideal world could be policy that was passed in a broken world that ended up being absolutely tyrannical and working against the people. And I think that is something that we must always, always consider: who is actually passing the policy. It's kind of like, you know, people are against anti-free speech laws, okay, and so am I. But if I was in power, I would pass some kind of legislation to prevent foreign groups denigrating our culture or removing our war memorials or do it, or, you know, there would be serious penalties for people that say, you know, damage something with intent to harm indigenous culture. So if you went to Stonehenge and you decided to throw paint all over it, there would be some kind of provision made in law that if you were to damage something that was of cultural importance to the indigenous people, you would face a greater sentence. I think that's important. And some people might say, oh, well, that sounds a bit like a speech crime, but it's not. That's a crime to protect us as a people and enshrine in law that we have special rights. Now, obviously, you know, when our current government passes laws like that, it's always to stop us saying and doing things. So I do think there needs to be some kind of, you know, subtle nuance in terms of, you know, who is passing the law and how, and also crucially, how that law would be interpreted. And obviously, in a homogenous white country, I think discouraging the usage of motor vehicles to create tight-knit local communities that rely on local shops rather than supermarkets would be maybe a bit of a step back in time, but it would be something that I would welcome, because when I was brought up, that's what mum used to do. You know, we'd go down to the village and we'd visit all the local shops. You know, Tesco wasn't even a thing when I was a little boy. I mean, believe it or not, that's how much the world has changed in 40 something years, which is, you know, which is obviously very sad. Anyway, moving on. Scaredy Cat gave $8. Thank you so much, and said, hi, Laura and Mark. Best wishes. Well, thank you so much for your continued support. It's massively appreciated. Glenn the Chinaman gave $3. Thank you so much. Said, Mark, how are there not more riots over these blatant attacks? Navarra Media wants people to believe an African man with zero Welsh blood is a Welshman. I think this is in relation to Southport. And if it is...
Is it Axel Ruder Cabana?
Just about. So basically Navarra Media have made a video of a black candidate at the forthcoming Welsh Assembly elections, and a major reform donor has come out and said, look, he ain't Welsh. he's not Welsh, he's black. And if he's black, he can't be Welsh. And Navarra Media are kicking off about it. I don't know why this has to be so controversial. This idea, you see, it's an interesting double standard, isn't it? No one would ever say I could be a Maori. And if I was to suggest that I was going to move to New Zealand and be a Maori, there'd be righteous outrage from everyone, from CivNats, from liberals, from leftists, from, you know, Black Lives Matter. But any black guy can be Welsh. And this was the issue with Axel Ruder Cabana, wasn't it? Axel Ruder Cabana was a Welsh choir boy. Well, he was about as Welsh as I am Nigerian. it's ludicrous. But this double standard is, again, it's one of these double standards that's so prevalent in British politics.
You just reminded me of that, I think, was it the BBC documentary that was about as recently, where they were like, like description of the attacker came out, and it turned out that he was British because he was born in Britain. It didn't stop Joe Marsh. And then Joe went, he's not Welsh, he's African, all right. And it was just says it how it is. I love that quote so much. It's the funniest thing I've seen. But yeah, I mean, these people are just anti-white. So Only white ethnicities are open to everyone. So in America, they say to white people over there, go back to Europe. That's your homeland. It's not your homeland over here. But over here, they say, who even are the English? Do you mean the Angles or the Saxons? Or they also, their other argument is, but we all came from Africa anyway. So depending on who they're talking to, it's just an anti-white argument where we're not allowed to exist and we're not allowed our own ethnicity. And like you say, you know, the Maori, 750 years old, the last successful large-scale invasion in this country was twice as long ago as that, 1,500 years ago. But the English apparently are not indigenous to this country. So these people are just anti-white and they're just so hypocritical.
The interesting thing is as well, when you look at 1066 and the Norman invasion of Britain, most of the Normans who fought in that invasion, most of the ones who actually came over, went back. And those who did stay were very, very racially similar to the Anglo-Saxons that they defeated, so much so that England remained largely Anglo-Saxon afterwards. It's incredible. But now we take in more people per year than came to Britain between 1066 and 1945, which is incredible when you think about it. In a single calendar year, more immigrants came here than came here, you know, for nearly 900 years post the last successful invasion of these islands, which is an incredible statistic, but it tells you about the swamping numbers that we're dealing with. Dawny B gave $5. Thank you so much. And she just said, thank you. Well, thank you to you. Glenn the Chinaman gave $3. Thank you very much. And said, someone should ask Ash Sarkar of Navara Media if her English husband is Bengali, since he can speak the language fluently. She's got a husband. Wow, I didn't imagine that. Do these attacks on British ethnicities gain any ground with the average person? What do you think, Laura? I'm going to look up Ash Sarkar's husband while you're answering it.
What was the question? Sorry. Yes, she does have a white English. I didn't know
that. Really?
Was that. Yeah. What was the question?
Let's have a look. God, he looks like a proper gimp, doesn't he?
Ugh. He's another one who it's different depending on who she's talking to. And she's openly said, you know, I'm only British when I'm arguing with racists.
Yeah, I mean, she is foul. But yes, I think what he's saying is, do these things that, like, actually gain any ground? These constant attacks, what are the effects of them? But, and I think people are getting sick of it. I think people are getting sick of hearing constantly that anyone can be Welsh, anyone can be English, anyone can be Scottish. I mean, look, it's a point of law, and it annoys people when I say this, but there is such a thing as a British citizen, unfortunately, and I didn't bring about those laws. But to be English, Scottish, or Welsh, that is an ethnic group. That is something you can't fill out a piece of paper and have it stamped by a government officer and become English, Welsh, or Scottish. But now they're moving into that territory, and I think that does genuinely annoy people. And unfortunately, the British people are a tolerant bunch. So I think when you say to the average white Brit, look, this guy's a British citizen and he's not white, I think they will accept that. I think, unfortunately, they will accept that. They'll say, like, well, fair enough, he's a citizen, you know, he's got a passport, he might have been born here. But I think this new move to claim these people are English, Scottish, or Welsh, it is maybe a step too far. I think it's maybe taking things that little bit too far. And that's the weird thing, isn't it? There's always this overreach. Our enemies can never just stop and take their foot off the gas. And in some ways, their overreach might be their downfall. I mean, what's your personal sort of interactions with people who have been offended by this? Because as I say, I do feel that people have sort of had it now with, you know, well, he's English, he's Welsh. And I think Southport was one of those breaking points. I think people were quite, there was a really crazy noise there, Laura.
Yeah, sorry, my laptop has just started buzzing like mad. I'll mute when you're talking.
Sorry. Well, no, I think Southport was a turning point because when people heard Welsh Choir Boy, they expected sort of a dorky, nerdy little white boy. They didn't expect a fully grown African man with a wild look in his eyes, with a, you know, that dead stare and crazy, like, fuzzy dreadlocked hair. That's not what people were expecting. And I do think that Southport thing was a turning point. But what are your thoughts?
Can you still hear me over the buzzing?
Yeah, the buzzing stopped.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, so on the census, I think it's been the last two censuses, they've had a question where they've asked people what do they identify as. So not what is your nationality, not what is your ethnicity, but how do you identify? And people like Sundar Katwala have said, well, I identify as English. So, it doesn't matter. You can identify as an octopus. It doesn't make you one. You've got your citizenship, your nationality, and you've got your ethnicity. A long time ago, they used to be the same thing, but legally today, obviously, they're not. I mean, I think the vast majority of people, I would say over 90% of British people, would say that somebody who had committed horrific attacks on us, like Axel Rudi Kvamme, is not Welsh. But I do think, because we've had it beaten out of us for so long, that a lot of British people would say that a footballer is English, or Mo Farah is English. And I think if you sat down and had a conversation with them and said, you know, but how is he English? English is an ethnicity, and explained it. I think they'd probably agree with you. It's not a political thought or opinion. It's just the default, because they're expected to believe that. I mean, they're even changing like Wikipedia articles so that ethnicity means something else, or that English means something else. And they're always putting out these polls. You know, polls are not there to gauge public opinion. They're there to influence public opinion. So they'll put out a poll where it'll be like 90% of people don't think that you have to be white to be English. And then people will think, oh, is that the normal opinion? I better think that too, or I'm racist. So I do think they're pushing it. And I do think a lot of our people will say that you are English if you can be English if you're black. But I don't think it's a political thing. I mean, the conversations that I'm having with people, whether it's, you know, other mums at toddler groups, or people in the park, or delivery drivers, or the butcher, lots of these people agree with us, and they're sick of everything. So I do think politically a lot of people are aligned with us, but maybe the terminology is not correct, or as we'd put it.
I think there was, as I said, I think there's certain things that push people over the edge. I think Southport was one of them. And I think one of the things that annoys me the most about this English, Scottish, Welsh thing is when you talk to some idiot who thinks because, you know, a man is allowed to play for the English football team, that makes him English, as if, like, you know, the Football Association or FIFA is the international arbiter of ethnicity. That's something that really annoys me. It's like, just because under FIFA rules he's allowed to play for the English football team doesn't make him ethnically English. That's not how it works. So yeah, I do think some people are getting more annoyed about it, but I also think there are still a lot of idiots out there who don't have a clue about ethnicity. And, you know, because the sports ball told them that's the truth. That's something.
What are they being taught in schools? Like, how young is this starting? Because my niece, who's now in high school, when she went to primary school, I went in once, and it was 2020 when all the Black Lives Matter riots were kicking off. And there was a massive display, I'm not joking, to George Floyd on the wall of a primary school. And it said on the display, George Floyd was a law-abiding citizen, and before this incident he'd never committed a crime in his life. That's what it said on the display. So I spoke to my sister Emma about it, and I was like, you need to go speak to the teachers and say, what's this rubbish? Why are you teaching my kid it? And she was a bit like, oh, you know, but I'm not confident with the arguments, and I don't want to cause trouble, and I don't want confrontation. And I was like, do you want me to come in with you and have a word? And she didn't end up saying anything. But how many kids are in that school, at primary school? I don't know, 100, 150. They're walking past that at that age, ages 4 to 11, and they're seeing that. And it very early, it gets, you know, into the brain, this anti-white stuff. So I'm not surprised that more people are growing up to believe this stuff.
I think there is a lot of brainwashing, and a lot of that brainwashing is based on lies, but in a way that's kind of a good thing. And hear me out here. If you base the ideology that you're pushing on people and forcing them to accept on truth, it is a lot harder for them to reject it. If you base that ideology on a tissue of lies, people then become very resentful when they realize that everything they've been taught is fake. And I think if you tell a lot of white people that they have to be guilty to be white, or they should feel guilt for being white, they might accept that in the short term. But if the reasons for white guilt are blatant lies, which they will figure out, they are then going to be absolutely resentful they were ever made to feel that way. And I believe that that resentment will then bubble up and lead to a pushback. But again, I've got to ask, and this is a genuine question, considering schools are now across England and Wales 60.3% white British. So we might as well just say 60% white British. So 40% of kids in schools are no longer Indigenous. There are 72 schools in Britain without a single white child. And there are 454 schools where there are fewer than 2% of children who are white British. Now, thinking about that and thinking about these demographics, are these displays that you're talking about solely designed to spread white guilt, or are they designed for something that is arguably more nefarious, which is making the ethnic minority children hate white people? Because these things have two effects, don't they? They have an effect on the people who are being painted as the bad guys, and they also have an effect on people that are being painted as the victim. So if you show this propaganda to a white child, they might feel like, oh God, I'm sorry, I should feel guilty, this is terrible, white people do awful things to ethnic minorities. But imagine what that does to non-white kids. How do non-white kids think when they see it? They might think, God, white people are bloody awful. White people are going to do terrible things to me. I should hate white people. I want to get revenge on white people. So I do think this is a, you know, this is a piece of propaganda that might may be aimed at causing white guilt, but it also might be aimed at effectively radicalizing non-white children and forcing them to see white people as their enemies.
It's made me think of that Channel 4 show that was on, it must have been like 7 or 8 years ago. Was it the school that cured racism or tried to end racism or something? And they had all these experiments where they had children of all different ethnicities, and they said, take a step forward if this has ever happened to you, or take a step backwards if this has ever happened to you. And it was all like microaggressions. So you've been treated differently because of your hairstyle, you know, stuff like that. And at the end, all the black kids obviously were the biggest victims, and all the white kids were the biggest perpetrators. And that's just a very sort of like on the nose example of how these opinions are seeping through the school. This is bad, this is good, you're the bad guy, you're the good guy. I do worry about it. And, you know, I put up a post on my Telegram channel the other day because my oldest is coming of school age this year. And it is a big worry. I mean, not just school, but her growing up. Me and Sam have got two girls. And it's you worry about so much. Like, am I teaching them the right things? What age do I address certain things? You want to protect them from everything, but then you want them to understand things and be streetwise. And it's a challenge for parents, it really is. I do think it was easier for our parents because things were obviously it was starting to turn, but things were different back then. Now, I mean, like you say, you look at the demographics of school. When I was in high school, we had 4 Pakistani girls in my year, and now I tell you what, the school that I went to, you walk past it now, drive past it, spot the white kid, it must be about 2/3 foreign. So it's a much, much bigger challenge for parents today.
I think it is a challenge, but I know this is a real sort of controversial thing to say. I don't think you should hide your kids away from it. I think one of the most dangerous things you could do is completely insulate your children from all the ills of the world. And then when they leave the home, it's kind of like jumping into the deep end. I think to some degree, kids need to understand what the world was like. And it's something that hardened me when I was a kid. You know, when we went to Leicester, first city where white people were, where white Brits were actually a minority. And I remember going there. That didn't make me want more cities to become like that. That made me want, you know, this not to happen. And I do think, obviously, this propaganda is powerful, but I don't think you can totally wrap people in cotton wool. And the reason I say that is because, unfortunately, the whitest areas of the country are often the areas where people are the most liberal and the most enthusiastic about welcoming migration. And, you know, take a look at Harrogate. Now, Harrogate's a perfect example. It's the nicest area, arguably, in the whole of Yorkshire in terms of wealth, in terms of social standing, in terms of house prices. But they vote Lib Dem. You know, they elect the most, you know, pro-migrant party at general elections. And I do think there is a degree where your kids need to see how bad it is to understand. And it was a real wake-up call for me as a kid when I saw other groups, other racial groups, sticking together, acting as one and treating each other like an extended family. I sort of thought, well, why are these people a team? Why shouldn't we be a team? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'm not suggesting you send your kid to a school where, you know, it's 2% white British and they're getting a beating every day in the playground. But what I am saying is, don't bring them up in a little bubble where they don't understand the threat. Because then as soon as they get out of that bubble, they'll either naturally be more liberal or they'll become easy prey.
Yeah, if you don't teach your children the truth, then at some point in their life, other people will try to teach them their truth, whether it's at university. I mean, my oldest daughter wants to be a vet. I know she's only four. She might change her mind. But obviously, if she does want to become a vet, she's going to have to go to university. And then that's a whole other level of brainwashing. I'm saying this as someone who's been through university myself and knows how bad it is. And that was 15 years ago or something.
My daughter wants to be a K-pop demon hunter, so...
well, Aunt Sally, $5.
Thank you so much. She said, thank you, Mark and Laura, for all you do for our people. Well, thank you so much. Shambolics gave $25. Thank you so much. And said, good to see you and Laura on stream again. Hat tip and deep bow to you both. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for your generosity. It means a lot. Rights for Whites gave $5. This is a good question, and I'm going to qualify this. He said, recently, you said you don't think people should be face out political like you, but then you were saying everyone should get involved with the demos and come along. How do you square that circle? Well, quite simply, let me explain what I meant. When I was speaking to young people, I was saying be careful taking the path that I chose. And what I meant by being face out is there's so many young people who are like, right, I want to do it all. I want to be online. I want to be a content creator. I want to be at the forefront. I want to put my whole life into this, my name on everything. That is very different to just attending a demo and being a face in the crowd. Now, when I got involved in politics, I was one of the first candidates to stand in Leeds. I remember the year I stood in Leeds, I think there was only... that year, one candidate. It was me. There was one candidate the year before, a guy called Dick Warrington, an old guy. And it was me on my own. Then I was immediately the leader of the young BNP. My name was front and centre in a way that few people will ever experience. But a lot of people wish to emulate that kind of path. And what I'm saying is, if you're a young person, don't throw yourself in at the deep end and start doing content creation and making speeches and trying to get noticed if you're not 100% sure of it, because it can end up damaging your life. Now, this goes in line with it. That doesn't mean you shouldn't be active. It doesn't mean you shouldn't get involved in the community. It doesn't mean you shouldn't join a political party. It doesn't mean you shouldn't be at the demos. But there's a big difference between being a face in a crowd at a demo, cheering people on and going to the pub afterwards, or delivering leaflets and helping out. There's a big difference between that and taking the path I did. Now, taking the path I did changed my life forever in a myriad of ways. And I'm not looking for anyone's sympathy here, because I've had some great times. I've met some wonderful people. I would say that the people who are my friends are the best friends that I could ever hope to have, and I love them dearly. The people I work with are the best comrades I could hope for. I would die for those people. I love my family, my children, and I'm proud of what I've achieved. So I'm not saying I've had a bad life, but it has been difficult. You know, there have been multiple prosecutions, multiple arrests, debankings, travel bans, attacks on my person, smears in the papers that have affected me and caused people that I've cared about to no longer want to know me. It's been a hard road. Now, I've lasted it and I've walked that path for 26 years. Not everyone can do that. And what I'm saying is, when you're a young person and you look at the long road ahead of you, something like the path I took can be a romantic fantasy that you think is going to be fun and games and revolutionary, but 2 to 3 years on that path and you might be a broken person. And what I'm saying to young people is, think long and hard about your future. Get involved, help in a way that doesn't put you on the front line like I've been, and make sure you understand what the commitment to the movement means. Because what I don't want to see is a generation of young people. And look, when I was young and I got involved, I had a lot of people on my shoulders saying, come on, Mark, it's going to be great. Come face out. You'll be the hero doing this. We'll have you doing this. Take this on. Be this in the party. And at the time, I thought these people like really cared about me, really saw something in me, that I was going to be this important cog in the wheel. And it sort of fed my ego to a large degree, I'll admit that. But I don't think those people always had my best interest at heart. I think they thought, well, this guy's going to do a lot of work for us. He's going to be front and center. We're going to get him, you know, being this cog in the machine. And he's going to work for us for a pittance, and he's going to struggle, but he's going to be a hard worker. And in some ways, I was probably taken advantage of. And I'm saying that I don't want to take advantage of young people. I don't want young people to come to me and me to be like, you know, the Fagin style character is like, yeah, join my gang and do this and this and get involved and get yourself into trouble. What I'm saying to young people is, be mindful of what the future may hold. Be mindful of the decisions you make. And when you're young and you're making foundational choices, it might not be the best thing to dedicate your university life to politics. It might be a better thing to keep your head down, get qualifications, get some kind of trade, and then be able to make an informed decision, whether you're a bit older, as to whether you want to just be a face in the crowd at demos, or whether you want to dedicate yourself to a political career. And the reason I say this is not because it's been terrible to me, or not because I want your sympathy. The reason I say this is for all the broken people that once stood alongside me. You know, you guys won't remember this guy because no one does. His name was Tony Wentworth. He was the guy that took over the Young BNP after I was unceremoniously dumped after being on Young Nazi and Proud. Where's Tony Wentworth today? I don't know. The last I heard of him, it had broken him down. He was unhappy. The movement didn't treat him well. He couldn't cope with the role of being in a leadership position, and he ended up crashing out. And what I'm saying is, I don't want young people. I want young people to grow with the movement and give something to the movement, but to get something out of it. I don't want the movement to be this grinding piece of machinery that pulls young people in, puts them on a pedestal, chews them up, then spits them out. Because there's a long history of young people who've been damaged in that way. I'm not saying don't come to the demos. I'm not saying don't put out a few leaflets. I'm just saying before you decide to go all in like I did, consider the ramifications, because not many people come out the other side. And I've not come out the other side yet. You know, I could get nicked tomorrow and be in jail for the next 5 years for something I said on a stream. You know, it's difficult. Just remember that. And what I'm doing is trying to make sure the mistakes of the past aren't repeated, that young people aren't pulled into this movement and their energy isn't sucked up and used and then they're spit out the other side. Do you understand what I'm saying, Laura? Am I making any sense?
Yeah, of course you're making sense. I think you just have to be honest about what it's like and the risks. And, you know, there's so much that you can do. You can do something behind the scenes. You don't even need to be face out at all. There's ways that you can help the movement and the cause if you want to. But the more responsibility that you take on and the more of a front man you become, you know, Mark will be honest to you and I'll be honest to you, it is tough sometimes. You know, getting debanked, not allowed any social media, basically unemployable, being attacked in the street, media smears, that kind of stuff. You do have to have a strong head. I mean, I'm just stubborn. I just refuse to allow our enemies to get me down. That's what drives me, I guess. But it is tough, but I think it's a personal decision. You know, what's your situation with your family? If you've got family support, it's a lot easier. What's your situation with your job? If you're self-employed and you have a trade, that's a lot easier than working for a company where you know you're going to get fired. So weigh up the risks, listen to people who are being honest about the risks and make a decision for yourself. But I definitely wouldn't be face out until you're an adult and you've, you know, if you want to go through uni, get through uni, get the job that you want to do and then make the decision.
Thank you. Right, so White's gave another $3. Thank you so much for your generosity. He says, my opinion is people get too scared about showing their face, and in reality, there is little risk if you are careful. People have been on the front of the papers on a march and nothing's happened. Well, look, that's what I mean. If you're a face in the crowd, it's different. What I was talking about was sort of walking that path like me and Laura have. Saunstup Saxon gave $60. Thank you so much. She said, hi, Mark. Replay lurker/viewer. Found you through Devon Stack about a year ago or so, and I love and appreciate all the good work you do. Here's a portion of the back pay I owe you for all the great streams. I only wish I could give more and more often at that. Much love from America. Well, thank you so much for your kindness. That is really appreciated. And thank you to Devon for introducing you to me, and thank you for the generous super chat. It's really appreciated. Tomorrow's Victims gave $25. Thank you so much. Said, nice to see Laura again. What a lovely and dignified woman. Sam is a lucky man indeed. Even I am stunned that the UK is now only 70% white British. Here in the States in the 1980s, it was still 80%. And now look at us, maybe 55%. And the demographics of the young is the most striking. It really does not take that long, does it? Well, look, I think both me and Laura will tell you that in the 1980s here, or in 1980 here, it was about 95% white British. And once the changes start happening, they accelerate so quickly. And just like in America, it's exactly the same here. Everywhere this happens, it's always the youngest brackets that change the first. But Laura, I'll let you respond to that, because obviously it was very kind about you and Sam.
Thank you. I'm not very good at taking compliments. I don't know what to say, but thank you. Yeah, I mean, the 1991 census, I think we were 94% white British. So obviously before that in the 80s, it was more than 94%, more than 95%. And it does change. I mean, you get these people into the country and then they have many more kids than us and they continue to come in and British people continue to leave. And it just snowballs from there. So it is shocking. It's happening fast. I mean, do you remember when the prediction was 2066 for us to become a minority? And even just in the last 5 years, that's dropped down to the 2050s because it's increasing so much.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, when you think about it, when I was born, Britain was more than 95% white British. And in my lifetime, we've seen a 25% shift, and likely in my lifetime, we'll see us become a minority if things continue. It's incredible how quickly it all happens. Delta Troiska 125 gave $10. Thank you so much, my friend. Thank you for the continued support. He said, Mark, what do you think is the best post-apocalyptic game? I think DayZ is pretty good, but The Last of Us is a good representation of how towns and cities look without being maintained. You know what? This is probably going to enrage people, but I haven't played DayZ. And when it comes to post-apocalyptic games, I've actually got a really weird pick that I enjoyed. It was on a console called the Wii U that didn't sell very well, but it was called Zombie U. And it was a game which took place in London. And you were sort of one of the last survivors in London in a zombie apocalypse. And you had to work your way through the streets, scavenging, beating zombies to death in a silent way without alerting them. It was really, really good. And also, I love the Resident Evil games. And I know people won't say they're post-apocalyptic. They're a bit sort of sci-fi zombie-like. But I do love the Resident Evil games. I haven't played DayZ, but yeah. Big up to Zombie U, which is a sort of forgotten game, but I really, really enjoyed it. You can get it now on PC. It's very atmospheric. People didn't like it at the time because it wasn't fast-paced. You weren't running around shooting zombies in the head. Every step you took, you had to be checking your corners, making sure you didn't bump into a zombie or startle some crows in the street and bring the horde running. Really, really good. And it was one of those games which was a bit like Dark Souls. It had like a permadeath system that when you died, you lost all your you lost everything you'd scavenged. You couldn't continue. And the only way to get your gear back was to find the zombie of the last character you played. And you had one chance to get your goods back. So if you can hunt that game down, it's worth playing. The Thin Red Line gave $14. Thank you so much, my friend. He said, I think you should always refer to foreigners as foreigners. It will catch on, I am sure, because it is the truth and most people know. Well, yeah, definitely agree that we should refer to them as, you know, migrants or foreigners, and we should always make that distinction, because when you don't, it kind of lets them merge in with us. Poit gave $25 and said, donation, thank you for your generous support and your continued support. It means a massive amount to me. All those who regularly donate, I can't thank you enough. Donald Ductator gifted 4 subscriptions. Well, thank you so much. Remember, if you get a gifted sub, please maintain it. That would really help. Bodden Nilsson gifted a sub. Thank you so much. Ethno Nationalist also gifted a sub. Thank you very much. SS Stan gave SS Stan 1 gave $14. Thank you so much. And said, joke, what do you call an American who helps fund Tommy Robinstein's Unite the Cringedom to the tune of $100,000? Shillman. Robert Shillman, in fact. What do you make of that, Laura, that Tommy managed to bring in $100,000 donation for his Unite the Kingdom event? It was from a Jewish American, but apparently, despite receiving $100,000 donation, he still needs more donos.
Well, I don't really know what to say about that other than, you know, I'm not surprised and on both counts, not surprised.
But I'll tell you this, Laura, right? And by the way, I'm not asking for a $100,000 donation. But you know, if a $100,000 donation came in now, my first response would be to be bowled over. I'd be so thankful, so grateful. Our next thing would be to say, look, obviously, you know, if I can meet you, if I can take you for dinner to say thank you, I will. But Tommy's response to the $100,000 donation wasn't to thank the guy. It wasn't to say, wow, you've set me up for the next couple of years. I can't thank you enough. What could I do to show my gratitude? Tommy gets the $100,000. And in fact, I can read it to you. I can read his response, because this is telling of the grift mentality. Somebody actually forwarded the email. Two people independently forwarded me the email, because people were actually so disgusted by this grift. In a major update for May 16th, Unite the Kingdom, rally in London. Tommy shares heartfelt gratitude for an extraordinary act of generosity from an American businessman and philanthropist, Dr. Robert Shillman, who has contributed a remarkable $100,000. The contribution has been absolutely vital. Without Shillman's backing, reaching this stage would not have been possible. Well, that's complete bollocks. His support reflects not only generosity, but it goes on. At the same time, describe this incredible contribution. There remains a crucial funding gap. This is his defining moment, and without continued backing, this event can stand as this event can stand as a powerful expression of unity, purpose, and cultural pride. I mean, can you imagine it? If somebody sent me like $100,000 dono now, what would you say to me, Laura, if my response was, "Well, thanks, buddy, but could everyone please dig deep and donate so more?" What would you think? Because I mean, it is a disgusting display of shameless greed, isn't it?
It just comes across as a bit ungrateful, doesn't it? Yeah, and sometimes you do things and I'm like, don't do it like that, Mark. But you are always good with people financially supported, as you do always, like, you do really appreciate, and you do always, you know, respond.
What do you mean by you think don't do it? What have I done? Give me an example of something I've done that's been awful.
You just go a bit far sometimes.
With what?
Just, I don't know, just
on stream or like in private when I get angry about things?
In private. Not on streams much, I don't think. In private you say stuff and I'm just like, okay, reel it in a bit. But nothing to do with money. But in fact, do you know what?
I know what this is in relation to.
It's not just you, it's the way that you and Sam talk to each other. Like when you phone each other up.
So what basically Laura doesn't like is man banter between me and Sam. Basically, she doesn't like men joking and having fun. This is why we as men can't have nice things. But yeah, I think seriously, it's a disgusting way to behave, especially considering the guy walks around in thousands of pounds worth of designer gear. You know, I buy my t-shirts and hoodies from Primark. Do you know the most expensive item of clothing I actually get is those cargo shorts I wear, because they're about 40 quid a pair. That's
the famous cargo shorts.
Yeah, they're the most expensive thing I buy. But yeah, you know, if people are generous to me, I genuinely appreciate it. And my money does not get spent on designer clothes. And I find it sickening what he's doing. And I find it sickening that people will read that email. Hardworking, decent families will read that email and send him even more money. And it'll be blown on basically a party for him and his wealthy buddies. It's something I find very, very deeply, upsetting. It's, yeah.
You would think that
somebody, Chief Moody in the chat is whining that my cargo shorts are so expensive. That's the only thing I ever buy that's expensive.
Yeah, I mean, I've never bought cargo shorts, so I don't know how much they usually cost. But I was going to say, I mean, maybe I'm being naive, but why does security, a stage, I'm guessing, but why does that seems like a lot of money for a demo? I would think that, I mean, when we do demos, granted they're not the same size, we don't ask for any money. We organise it. We turn up on the day. We've got the sound system. We've got the banners. We do it. I guess it's for security and a stage and stuff, but it just seems like a lot of money, really.
I'm now reevaluating my life choices because apparently these are expensive shorts. In fact, they're not even as expensive as I said. I've just looked them up. They're $34.95. I don't think that's you're a woman. Is $34.95 too much to spend on cargo shorts? That's the question.
No. No, I don't think so. You can treat yourself to some. All you ask for is some cargo shorts and a can of Red Bull. So knock yourself out.
Yeah, I don't think they're people say, what brand are they? They're just a non-branded. I think they're called something like Surplus Division, military surplus cargo shorts. So, you know, they're not, you know, they're only $34.95. I don't know. I mean, like, usually when I buy T-shirts, they're £3 from Primark. So That's sort of my, that's my limit for t-shirts.
You sound like what Sam does.
Mr. Smalls 14 gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, great show, fam. With every word, we're breaking the folk under the we're breaking the folk under and destroying the illegitimate. Well, thank you so much. And that brings us to the end of tonight's Super Chats and the end of the show. Thank you to everyone who donated. Laura, we're coming up to the end of the show. It's nearly 9 o'clock. You should have the final say because you're the guest. You've obviously scolded me for my man banter with Sam and going too far, calling each other probably things like Gaylord, which
sometimes
you prep. What, you're bored, Gaylord? And Laura's like, you're going too far.
I won't reveal your private conversations, but sometimes you phone each other up and you're just like, all right, Bender. And then you'll be like, you'll say something about visiting prostitutes. And I'm just like, Jesus, is this how men talk to each other?
It's just banter.
Yeah, I'm a woman, so I don't get it.
Just banter. It's just banter. Oh, Theus Labyrinth gave 5 subscriptions at the last minute. Thank you so much. That is very kind of you. Yes, bantering with men about their inability to get sex and the fact they're bald, gay, etc. is something that we do. So Laura's let the cat out of the bag. We are blokes. Laura, do you have any final thoughts before you humiliate me and your husband any further on stream?
Just thank you for inviting me. It's been nice to talk about politics and stuff as well. And, you know, now Sam's back full time and he's finished his book and his book is out and he's caught up with the orders. Maybe I can now have a bit more time to do some more political work. And just here, he has his book, Legal, Truthful, Guilty. If you don't have a copy of Sam's book, it's only £10 from the Grammar Towers website. And Mark reviewed it recently on Book Club, and it's a really great book. I'm not just saying it because I'm married to him. It's heartwarming, it's funny, it's shocking as well at times. So if I can do a shameless plug for my husband, it is to get a copy of his book. But yeah, I hope everyone enjoys the rest of your Wednesday, and no doubt I'll see you soon after the next demo. We've got the PA camp coming up and conference and stuff, so yeah, come and get involved.
And also, the book does have a really well-written foreword written by me about Sam. And look, the foreword is my actual thoughts about Sam. It's not banter. It tells you what I really think of him. And obviously, we do have jokes, but I do admire the man. He's a very close friend of mine. And joking aside, if you read the foreword in this book, that is how much I admire him and what I truly think of him and how highly I do regard him. But I just want to say thank you to Laura. Thank you to everyone who donated so generously. If you're watching on replay, don't be shy hitting that donate button. Not many people do, but thousands watch. It would help if you did. You can now subscribe to me on Substack. My Substack is free to view, but anyone can subscribe to me there, making a monthly pledge, which would make a huge difference if people can do that. I've got some really good articles up there. And finally, I just want to thank everyone who tuned in. Thank you to Laura. Thank you to everyone who donated. And thank you to everyone who tuned in. It's been a great show. I've really enjoyed working with Laura. She's the kind of woman that I could talk to for hours, but I know she'll probably want to go and watch some episodes of The Walking Dead now with Sam. So I'm going to let her go. Anyway, thank you so much. Thank you to everyone who tuned in. You know I love you all, and I'll see you all again soon. I'll be back on Friday for a stream and back next week for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review.